Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another episode of From the Vault, the series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week, we present a fantastic documentary about life as a coal miner in Hazard County, Kentucky, 1963. Featuring interviews with residents of Hazard County who discuss the Coal Miners Union, the harassment union miners faced from large mining companies, and the unofficial strikes that were being organized in Hazard County. This program, called 40 Cents a Ton, was produced out of Pacifica station WBAI in New York City by Hamish Sinclair and Bob Heifetz, engineered by Stanley Aronowitz and Sam Sanders. All speakers you are hearing will be identified at the end of this program. And now, 40 cents a ton.
The agreement of the operators to begin this fund.
This was 1947.
In 1947. Mm-hmm. Hospitals, I take it, were not the only considerations in the fund.
No, the welfare fund really does two big jobs. More than half of the monies expended each year go for pensions.
They were given their hospital care, their hospital insurance for the miner himself, his wife, and all of his legal dependents.
The hospitals were built 56, 57, thereabouts.
We had one rail mine, and we lost $230,000 in 51, and we paid the union $210,000 in royalties. Without that, we'd been in good shape. We hadn't had to pay the 40 cents a ton.
Well, in the meantime, automation came in, and they didn't need as many men to work the mines, but the union was actually getting more money. What difference did it make? Well, they were getting 40 cents a ton royalty on the coal. Well, actually, that was a death knell for the operators. They had no business signing it. They knew when it went through that they could not keep that up and continue to pay wages of $24, $25, $26, $27
a day. Of course, the 40 cents a ton is just an impossible load on the operator.
Of this 40 cents a ton, do you think it's a higher portion of the production cost than any of your other production costs?
Very definitely so, very definitely so, and we shouldn't have to pay any. This industry cannot stand one penny for any support of any union or anything else.
Well, then this comes to something else, and who would then pay for the hospital and medical facilities necessary for the mining community? How would that be set up?
The people you work for, who pays your hospitalization? Who pays your insurance? I think that's the whole answer. We're an industry just like anybody, any other concern. Does the automobile industry, do they pay 10, 12, 14, or 15% on their product back through some union to be supported? Should we pay the union dues, the monthly dues? We should pay the 40 cents. Why shouldn't we pay the union dues?
Cents a Ton, a Pacifica radio documentary about the unofficial strike of Kentucky miners, produced from recordings made in and around Hazard, Kentucky, in March 1963.
My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son, and I'll stick with the union until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Don't scab for the bosses. Don't listen to their lies. Us workers never had a chance unless we organize. Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Well, there was a time kind of like that. Now, I was small. They was a time way back, you know, and well, I was about 12, I guess. Men had to go in and work all day. They'd go in the mines and they'd hardly ever see daylight. They'd go in the mines and they'd work for $1.60 a day till Johnny L. Lewis put this union. He got they all the men joined the union. And the union come through here, and then after hit got on the way, then men went to getting good wages to live. Well, everything around here, you see, then everything went to building up. Hazard was a poor town till the union come through here, and it went to building up.
Coal operations started in the Hazard Coal Field when the railroad came into this country in 1912. Along from that time up until World War I, it grew into a substantial industry.
How many people were here in Hazard at that time?
1,000 to 1,500 people.
What did they do here?
I don't know. Just farmed and lived off of the lands, all I can say. I became interested in the coal business personally about 1930. My family, however, had been in the coal business since 1917. In 1917, the field was non-union, and during and after World War I, we had good coal business.
It was a general period of prosperity, and several years prior to this time, this area was organized. There was scattered strikes, supported by the union for a long period of time, but eventually the strike was broken. And about 1922 and 23 is the time that the union was destroyed, and the men let the union go at that time. The coal operators was very vicious toward the union at that time and imported gunmen and guards, and they were abusive, of course, to the miners, and that contributed also to the destruction of the union.
Then in the late 20s, we had the stock market crash, and the whole world went to pieces. In the reorganization of things, the union came into this field, and we became unionized along about 1932.
Lewis came in here in 1933, I think, didn't he? Yeah.
That is right, in 1933, under the NIRA Act. The union was reorganized in most of the districts, coal mining districts throughout the United States.
And this included District 30?
That did include District 30.
With the union here and the federal government priming the pump, there was no way to go but up. We were rock bottom in 1932, the early 30s, and we gradually went up in the coal business until about 1939 when the World War began. And then we gradually build up, and the fields were producing at top limit from then until about 1946. And then from 46 to 48, in resupplying all of the things we'd run out of and remanufacture things, why, we had real good coal business until 1948. And that's when the definite decline started.
When this field was first opened 50 years ago or more, I think that the coal operators were making a killing. They were taking the lumber and the coal from this country, and they weren't putting any of the money that they made from it back into the development of this thing. This really is one reason for our economic condition today, was the fact that the wealth was taken from here and taken somewhere else.
There has never been, I don't believe, much of a community effort, for instance, to get Hill-Burton funds and build first-rate community hospitals. And there are no other examples of community efforts in this respect. The accident rate is very high in the mines, and this was one of the things the fund found when it came into the area. It found a significant number of miners who had been injured in the mines, but who had not been able to get adequate medical care. The miner, I suppose, paid for most of the medical care that was provided in the area on the traditional checkoff system. So much money was checked off of his check every 2 weeks or every month by the mine operator and given to the camp doctor or given to the hospital, in return for which he was supplied with medical care, or at least a minimum stated amount of medical care. He had to pay extra for maternity cases, house calls, and medications and shots and things like that. You go back and read the minutes of the annual meetings of the UMW, you'll see references to this periodically from the time John L. was first president. Then in 1946, this subject was practically his whole speech when the contract was renegotiated between himself or the union and the operators. And then in 1947, I would gather that he decided that this had to be. Some way had to be worked out whereby his miners could get better, more complete medical care. And that was when the big strike took place, when the mines were turned over to Julius Krug in the Department of Interior, when Admiral Boone made his famous medical and sanitary survey of the area, in which he said right out that the medical and health conditions of this area represented a national disgrace, when Krug and Lewis agreed on the contract, which set up this unprecedented instrument, a welfare fund, which was supported by 5 cents per ton on every ton of coal mined by the signatories to the agreement. And finally, the operators accepted that. Then when time went on, it went from 5 cents to 10 cents to 20 cents to 40 cents without anybody really complaining, and today it's 40 cents a ton. The decision to build these hospitals was made because after the medical program of the welfare fund had been in operation about 4 years, it was clear that more would have to be done to raise the level of medical care in this area.
I think the hospitals are fine, and I wish they could keep the hospitals on, but I don't hardly think it's fair to take 40 cents a ton royalty. In other words, the consumer pays the royalty, not the miner. I'm paying the miner's hospitalization when I use coal, see. I think they're fine, but that's just really forcing it off of one person and giving it to another.
None of these figures, none of these costs can you just pass on to the customer. They got this thing in by saying we could just add the 40, the operator wasn't costing the operator anything, he just passed it on to his customer. But that isn't the case at all. We go out and bid on a piece of business that might be this month at $3. Next month, when you come through, they might cut the price 25 cents a ton. You either meet it or don't run. Either meet that price or you don't run. So there's no way to pass it on. We've just got to get what we can get for the coal, and wages have gone up, and the price of coal has gone down. And it's gone down to a point that we just can't exist and pay these high wages. But the small hand-loaded mines, $12 to $14 a day, as much as they can possibly pay and stay in existence.
Well, I think that there's a great number of them that can pay their wages.
They couldn't keep going at that pace. It was impossible. They were paying such high wages along with the royalties. They had to stop somewhere.
Was there much non-union mine operation in 1948?
Practically none. Practically none.
So the operation of non-union mines has been a development since 1948.
That is correct. There wasn't any demand for the coal, and we had to get what the consumer would pay us. And during that time, every mine in the field practically has gone broke.
What has happened in, say, the last 20 years, these larger companies with properties of maybe 30 or 40 different mines, they have shut down their inefficient mines, and maybe out of 30 mines, they won't have five operating today. but it is five of the mines in the place that they can get the best tonnage per man. Well, now, at the same time, back in southeastern Kentucky, maybe an operator won't have but one or two mines, and that is all he's got. Well, now, he cannot, I mean, when he shuts down, he's through if he just has one mine.
So this mine quit, and at least two of the boss men who were working there at the mine at the time, and they called themselves operators.
Now, many of these mines that were closed have been reopened on a lesser scale by local capital, local people.
Using machinery suitable for that kind of mining?
Well, not necessarily machinery, but working a smaller group of men with a smaller wage scale. And reclaiming many of these mines, which were abandoned by your large companies. They have taken leases on them.
So they cut the wages $15 a day. Now that was starting in, and that operator found out then, by leasing to these two guys, that he could break the union down.
Let me just interrupt for a second. When did this happen?
1952. So this other guy then, about 6 or 8 months after that mine quit, he broke his mine down. He leased it out to two guys. And they cut the wages to $12 a day. Well, they got by with that. After a while, all the mines began to quit and do the same thing. Blue Diamond Coal Company, they quit two mines. We had 20 working mines in 52 when this started. Had 20 union mines in this county. And today, we've only got one. They've been beginning to quit and lease out that way, and these little operators come around and open up truck mines here and there.
The growth of the truck mine no doubt could be attributed to the war years where there was a great demand for coal. But after the demand for coal fell off, they continued to try to stay in business and compete with the larger mine, which I think they could not do in many cases, and for that reason, I think that is one of the things that has driven the wages in the truck mines down to this starvation wage that they are now paying. We've been informed by men that work in those mines that they are paid from $4 a day to $8 or $10 a day, as compared with the $25 to $26.68 in the union mine.
Your truck mine is where the railroad is not. It may vary from 2 miles to 20 miles from a railroad, which puts a further cost to production of trucking it to the rail where it is loaded into the railroad coal car.
A rail mine is one of the bigger mines that... See that load of coal over there?
Yeah.
See that train load of coal? Well, that's probably come from a rail mine.
They load directly from the mine through the tipple into the coal car, which where the railroad is built right to the mine itself.
They had a contract in 1959 that they give the men $24.95 a day wages. They gave 40 cents a ton royalty.
I personally started a small truck mine and ran it non-union for 3.5 years. And every man I had on the job were more than satisfied. I was paying them at that time $1.25 a ton, and they split the gross income between them.
These men came out, and they stayed out for a few days, so they went to the field workers, and he told them going back to work, and he'd get their wages for them. He'd take it up and make them pay them the back time. So these guys went on out to work, and they worked for about 2 months, I guess. They went back to find out about the case, and the man said they didn't have one. It got beat. Only thing he knew to do if they wanted to work for $15 a day to go ahead.
The United Mine Workers didn't pay any attention to what the men drew in their wages so long as they got their 40 cents a ton royalty and the dues off the men.
They went on, and these other guys seemed that were making $24 and $26 a day seemed to forget their fellow man and wouldn't quit. They worked on because they were getting wages. These companies were supposed to pay us 20 cents, 40 cents royalty on the ton. They quit paying that. 1959, we came out on a strike. The men all came out.
What was the issue of the strike in 1959, and where did it happen, was it?
It happened right here in Prairie County, and these men all came out, and they all were having a strike. The union were backing them up at that time.
Yes, in 1959, we made an attempt to district-wide to organize the truck mine. The truck mine operators canceled their contract. And we were interested in giving the truck mine membership all the protection we could, and we notified them that if they refused to work and forced the operator to sign a contract through their efforts of striking, that we would assist in feeding them, and we did that. We spent several $100,000 in this area during that period assisting the truck mine members to exist. During that period, there was some violence, and the coal operators sued the union, and we're still in a lot of lawsuits, damage suits, because of that period of reorganizational efforts. I would say that, however, that we feel that a lot of this was brought about by these mines that couldn't make a profit. Many of the tipples were burned. They were injured, and in many cases, the insurance would amount to more than the profits from these mines. And we feel like that it was actually a case where they saw how to get paid twice.
How much in damages did it cost the UMW in that 1959 strike?
Really, I have no figures on that, but there has been judgments awarded in several cases, and those cases have been appealed, and we actually don't know what the final outcome will be. Well, I would say it would be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
How long did that strike last?
I'd say around 7 or 8 months. The men gradually went back to work, and of course that broke the strike. Most of them went back to the mines that they had struck at. Some of them got jobs at other places, but I would say that the strike was completely broken within 7 or 8 months.
Since that time, things have got worse. They never get no better. Anytime an operator gets a chance to cram you down, he sets his foot on you. If he gets to where he can put you in bondage, that's what he wants to do.
No miner who had not worked in a mine for a year lost his card. Prior to that time, as long as you did not take a job outside the industry and continued to pay your dues, you could continue to receive the benefits of the welfare fund.
The coal mine stopped where my husband worked. And then they drawed nearly all the union cards then, and they took their hospital cards. We've not had any medical care. Must have been about 59. He was cut off. We had a union card then.
Recently, the fund withdrew the cards of those miners who were working for coal companies that were delinquent in payment of their royalties to the fund. And this affected, really, quite a large number of people, particularly in this area.
And none of the children been ill? You have 6 children.
No, sir. I've been lucky about that. I've been in hospital a time or two, but we still owe for it.
How much do you owe for it?
The 98-something.
Inasmuch as the fund must operate on a pay-as-you-go basis and must avoid criticism by owning too much property, the planning for the expenditure and the benefits necessarily must be related to the money that has been brought in within the last year or so. In the last few years, with less coal being mined by union mines, the figure has dropped. That is one cause for changes in the benefits given.
On October 12th, the director of the fund, Miss Roach, announced that as of July 1, 1963, that 4 of the hospitals at Middlesboro, Hazard, Whitesburg, and McDowell, unless turned over to some other auspices, would have to be closed.
What do you feel about this withdrawal?
Well, I think that the union just let its men down. It was the union's job to either make the coal operators keep paying this as agreed in the contract, it was the union's job, really, to take care of its men, but they didn't. They just let the men go.
And then the men began to see that their hospital cards were no good. By then, when this strike started, they had them down to where they had to work on it.
It's bad. You just don't know what kind of steps to take. You don't know what to do when you got your children standing around crying for something to eat, and you just don't know where to get it, or don't know which way to start to get it. If I just get nervous or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Why should we sit around when there's a living there for those people and they know nothing else but mining and see this go on? I'm not going to do it. It's a shame. It's a disgrace to the human race what's going on in the state of Kentucky.
Listen, friends and workers, please take a friend's advice. Don't load no more coal now, don't pull no more, till you get a living price.
That was 6 months ago. I was raised a union man, see? And Blue Diamond Coal Company, I worked for them 24 years in a union mine. Well, see, that mine worked out. Automatic, I didn't have no job. Well, I stayed out of these scab mines just as long as I could, see, till my family got to starving, see, and I had to go back. And then when I went back to them scab mines, I worked 6 months, and I heard about this picket line was keeping on coming down the river. I told some boys I was riding with, I said, well, boys, I said, I hope how quick it comes. First time I get up with it, I'm falling out. Them boys said, what's that? I said, boys, I said, that's the old-time religion coming back, and I fell out the picket line. That's right. That's how I come to enjoy it. Because I know what it is. I want a decent, we just want a decent wages, you know, our wages back, where we can live, feed our families, get our hospital back, and send our kids to school.
Grant, do you have a hospital card?
No, sir.
They work them long hours, and they work them for nothing. They need medical, they need clothes, they need food.
What have the pickets been doing?
Well, we got on a picket line, and we'll be starting to see some miners, you know, to talk to them, to get them to come out with us, and we'll come to a trespassing sign. It says no trespassing going up to the mines, and probably we'll be going along in a car. And first thing we know, we'll be looking down in the barrel of about four or five carbine rifles or high-powered rifles, one with these gun thugs. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't want to hurt nobody. We just want a decent contract to live. So we'll stop and stand there till the miners comes out. Mm-hmm. And stop them and talk to them. And they tell us, see, we ain't been getting too much to eat, you know. They say, when the groceries comes in here and you show us that we're going to get something to eat, come back and let us know it, and we'll come out of these mines and be with you. Because they're union men in a way.
And these men are afraid to quit because they have their families thrown out. And we've had one boy since his strike started, they throwed him out, threw his things out of the house. And you take a man, if he's not got anything to eat or any way to live, it's hard to get him out of the coal mine. It's hard to get him to quit work. As long as he can earn a dollar here and there, why, he still wants to do that. Because some of the school kids can't even have lunch at school. Some of them are bare of clothes. And they're in desperate need, most of them. And these men are getting their light bills taken out now. The juice company has got to where they won't cooperate a bit. They, just as soon as the bill's due, if the man don't pay it, they cut his juice off. He's got no more electricity. The high sheriff in the county, he operates a mine. So he's got every deputy he can get out there, gun thug, he's hard and put him out. When he first came out and they began to picket the mines, he began to hire every gun thug he could and put him on the sheriff force. He's got, the last count I had, the last that I heard him count on was 72 deputies. Only three of these guys have been approved by the official courts.
Do you think that the United Mine Workers of America is in sympathy with the strike?
Well, I don't know, but I know they should be. Well, they've not give us anything more than just what the men that's working would give us that belongs to you. They individualism. But then the men here are unionism. These men in Kentucky here on this, in this union field here, won't see the union. They love the union. You can find John L. Lewis's picture in most of their homes hanging on the wall, and they very near worship it. Because John L. has been a great man, we know that. He'd been a great organizer. He'd been a man that would stand up when he wanted something. He'd say it's that and that, and that's all. Mm-hmm. And we, men all respect John L. Lewis in this part of the country. And we think he's done a wonderful job. Up till this, we don't know what's happened, that we've actually been let down.
Do you think you're going to win the strike?
Yeah, I think we will.
What will winning the strike mean then?
Winning the strike will mean that we'll get our hospitals back, we'll get our wages back, where we can work and support our families and send them to school and keep them from starving, feed them.
Would the UMW, you do think, support the strike?
They would have to.
Why'd you say the unions would have to?
Because we're still, see, we was union men when they took our hospital card. And if we win this, why, this 40-cent roll, they'll go in there for a hospital, and they'll have to take us back.
Well, some people think that unions are too strong. Union leaders should go back where they belong. But I wish that they could see a little more poverty, and they might start to sing a different song. Well, the badge of Sheriff Combs always shines, and when duty calls, he seldom ever whines. Well, I don't like raising thunder, but it sort of makes you wonder when he runs the law and also runs the mine. Well, mining is a hazard in Hazard, Kentucky, and if you aren't mining there, friends, you're mighty lucky, because if you don't get silicosis or pay that's just atrocious, you'll be screaming for a union that will care.
So now they've got the union broke back down again to where they can slave men. This is slavery. It's nothing else.
And they just simply attempting through various means to step up efficiency and get more tons of coal per dollar expended for labor and materials.
Your labor, if you're paying scale, would run somewhere around $2.75 a ton. Then your mine supplies will run you somewhere between 75 cents and a dollar a ton. Of course, you've got your 40 cents a ton welfare. And if you do not own the land you own, you will pay somewhere between 10 and 40 cents a ton for the coal mined on the land.
That's a royalty to the landowner.
That's right. Of course, most landowners actually get between 10 and 25 cents a ton. The Workmen's Compensation Act in this state has really raised the price on compensation. I think the rate now is about 12%. Per $100. And then, of course, your Social Security keeps going up. Your unemployment compensation keeps edging up. And if you're making a lot of money, that doesn't amount to too much, but when you're breaking even or losing money, and the more men you have on the payroll, that really mounts up.
When you add up all these production costs, how much does it cost you to produce a ton of coal?
Somewhere between $4 and a quarter and $4 and 75 cents.
And what market price are you getting for your coal?
From 4.25 to 4.55.
The cost is much less to the truck mine producer.
Are the rail mines more efficient or less efficient output per man day than the truck mines today?
Well, I'd say by and large the rail mines are more efficient than the truck mines. Well, they represent a competitive threat because they are not forced to pay the high wages or the welfare payment, or the fringe benefits, and the men work longer hours per day.
You are one of the few union operating coal mines in the area here. How long do you think you'll be able to keep this going?
Well, I think I'll be lucky if I can last two more years at the most. I'll put it this way. We have shut down about four mines in the last 10 years, and almost every one of the mines that was shut down, and after several years going back and looking over the figures and seeing if there was anything we could have done, almost every one of them would have lost about 40 cents a ton for the last couple of years.
The employer then had to either mechanize or shut down his underground mine and start buying coal from truck producers, which he could buy much cheaper than he could produce it himself because the truck producer was not paying the wage scale that he was forced to pay. The truck mines would not have developed had there been a more flexible contract offered to the rail mines by the United Mine Workers.
Southeastern Kentucky is under a national contract, which with the economic situation in the coal business, that they cannot afford to pay.
I think the coal industry is like any other business. For instance, we had a silica sand plant here close by in eastern Kentucky. It couldn't compete with the other sand-producing areas, and it closed down. Now, that's what's going to have to happen in some of these places, whether they're uneconomical, they need to close down. If they can't pay a living wage, then they should close down, just like any other business.
The contract for the last several years has been made first with the northern mines, and then the union comes to us and say, now, here's a contract. This is what you're going to have to sign. And we have never actually been able to negotiate or have any say in the contract because it's already a signed item when we get it.
Well, they have representatives that set in on the making of the contract, or they have that right to. But once the contract is worked out and negotiated, it's accepted as a standard contract and has a provision that states that where that the union negotiates a more favorable contract with some other group or some other company, then the people that have signed that contract has a right to accept the more favorable term.
Yes, we have to sign the contract that is made up by the North. It's a matter of either take it or leave it. The United Mine Workers tell us now the Northern operators have signed it, and if you do not sign it, we will have to shut you down. And, of course, we are just small in the field of producing coal.
It's very difficult for us to try to negotiate a contract that would be more favorable to some other operator than the one that we've already negotiated and working under at the present time. It is the United Mine Workers' position that our responsibility to all of the coal miners is to attempt to create more jobs for them at a living wage, which we have been trying to do.
Why do you think the northern operators don't mind these rates as much as operators in eastern Kentucky?
The big difference would be, for instance, in Peabody Coal Company. If you've noticed in the last few years, their stock has gone up four or five-fold what it was a few years back. And I noticed that their dividend this year was up. They made more money this year than they did last year. They've got a profit where most of us in southeastern Kentucky have no profit to start with. And they can afford to go on paying those wages and paying the 40 cents, where those of us in southeastern Kentucky are not making money now. We just can't afford to do it.
Several reasons why they can produce coal cheaper than anyone else is because they have huge deposits of coal that can be stripped, which means that they can load it out with a shovel, and they now have one of the largest electric shovels in the world that can load a train load of coal with one dip. They also are close to waterways. They can transport their coal, I'd say, at one-tenth of the price it cost the operator in this field ship coal. They also are able to command a relationship with the consumer so that they can go in and sell a million tons of coal to a consumer, such as TVA, that all the producers in this area couldn't possibly fill.
Well, I don't think that you can take any contract in the coal mining business and have it good for all the mines to be under the same contract. You've got different working conditions in southeastern Kentucky, parts of Virginia and West Virginia and Tennessee. You've got awful small, thin seams of coal, and you cannot get the same tonnage per man out of them that you can a higher seam of coal.
4 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet, probably 9 feet was the largest one.
Number nine seam is 9 feet deep.
Or is that an unusual
one? Those are gone now. We don't have any seams that wide anymore. They worked the bigger seams out first, see, and now we have just the smaller seams. All of our hills around here are riddled with old mine shafts. And
they're operating in these seams between 26 and, say, 36 inches, which is very small to be mining coal in. Now, over in Virginia at this Clinchfield operation, I think they have maybe up to 18 feet of coal that they can mine.
If you're working in 5 foot coal or 6 foot coal, you naturally can load more coal than you could if you're working in 4 feet coal. Because when you say 4 feet coal, now that means the thickness of the coal, that's the thickness between the top rock and the bottom rock that the coal is between. And when you say 4 feet, that means that you're on your knees loading coal.
If you're using machinery in these low seams, you can have your equipment to where you cannot see over it. And if there's something happens on the other side, you've got to completely crawl around it in place of hopping over it, or if it's something you want to look at, you just can't see it. You've got to have somebody else on the other side or go yourself to see what's going on.
And this then becomes a costly time factor.
Yes.
Then how does that relate to your problems of selling the coal?
Well, you have less coal put out per man. The tonnage per man is less. Your average mine in this county the last few years would run, say, between 150,000 tons and maybe 300,000 to 400,000 tons. I think I noticed in Coal Age in December where one Peabody mine was coming out with their, I believe it was the 15th millionth ton for that particular year.
Of course, the solution is that we could somewhere or other increase the need for coal in the United States, either by cutting off residual fuel oil or by regulating gas so that it couldn't compete under artificial means that it does now, or by cutting off the import of gas from Canada and Mexico, which apparently is abhorrent to our State Department, or we could arrive at a flexible contract whereby that a man, whether he worked in a truck mine or a rail mine or a strip mine or wherever he worked, was paid for the coal that he produced. And that would be, of course, on a piece work rate, a tonnage rate whereby they would make any day the same amount of money that they were making now, except they were paid by the ton. It would not only cut the cost of this rail producer, but it would increase the efficiency of his men, because the more tons that they produced, the more that they would make. Then he could compete with the truck operator who is now paying a tonnage rate. And his cost is lower, because if the man doesn't produce the tons, then he doesn't get the pay.
Of course, that would have to include eastern Tennessee and parts of Virginia. But all of us in the same situation, if a contract was worked out suitable to all concerned, then you would not find these men working under substandard wages. And you would not find the trouble that the United Mine Workers is having on its own hands. Now, we have most of your rail mines have mechanized. And if you could get your mechanized mining on a tonnage basis to where you pay those men for what they do, that would, to me, as far as the truck mine situation is concerned, if you would work it out fairly for the rail mines and have them all painted and have it on a fair basis, your truck mines would just dry up.
The coal industry is the next thing to being dead.
I don't agree with you, Reverend Nagel. The coal industry is just as alive as it's ever been. As a matter of fact, there'll be more coal mined in the future than ever before, but the coal industry is being mechanized.
The employment is true, is being dwindled away due to mechanization. Now, for instance, we mine almost as much coal now as we've ever mined in the history of Perry County, but it's all done by machinery. But there won't be the volume of money, it's true, from the coal industry as to employ people and things like that.
This is a one-industry county that the only thing we have here is coal mining, and once a man loses his job in the coal mine, he cannot find employment in this section at any other thing because there's just not any other industry.
We believe, us older miners believe, that some of us have lost our jobs. We know in some cases that this is true due to the fact that the older men, after they pass 45 or 50 years old, if their job is strenuous at the mine, where they can no longer produce, that the company, when they do have to cut off men, those are the men that they cut off. And consequently, they're not eligible for even their miner's pension. They're not eligible for Social Security benefits. And since the only way that a man can get Social Security benefits before he is 62 years old, he almost has to be a dead man in the beginning. So consequently, with some other industry that wouldn't be as strenuous as coal mining, there might be a possibility where part of these older people could get jobs whereby they could produce by their labors for an additional 10, 12 years. So that would take up this extra slack that's going to be in eastern Kentucky unless something else is done.
We need to have retraining of jobs where men from this section might go out to the West Coast or in other industries where there's a need for labor, and give them the training here and an opportunity to find jobs elsewhere.
We've been in a depressed area for 5 or 6 years.
How many working men are unemployed? Do you know what the percentage is?
16%. Our state government set our county up at 16%, and we have 34,000 population, a little better than 34,000. So you could figure it from that. And it's about the same in Letcher, about the same in Pike and Floyd.
Do you think that this unemployment in the area is going to last a long time, or do you think it's a short-term thing that's going to pass over?
Well, I think it's going to last a long time unless our surplus population moves away.
So we have a real
a fast-growing population and nothing for the population to live on. You might not realize it, but the mountains of Kentucky are people who have large families, and actually the mountains of Kentucky has populated several of the adjoining states in many ways. Take, for instance, Ohio and Indiana. My father always said that Kentucky took Ohio and never fired a shot because our people went there and settled, see?
The young man or young lady who graduates from Hazard High School or Combs or Napier have very little chance of getting a job, even in Perry County, not just in the city of Hazard, but in Perry County. Jobs are at an absolute minimum. The opportunities for them are really nil. They can, they can't work in the mines anymore. There isn't that much business that's going to hire new people. The business people already have all of the people that they need, and they're not about to add more people. They can't afford to add more people, and there is really nothing for them to do. I would imagine most of them at this point leave not just Hazard but Perry County if they're going to find work.
These are 17-year-olds.
17-year-olds is when they graduate from high school. There's nothing for them to do.
So what do they do?
Well, most of them have to migrate from here north. Many of them go north, even out of our state into Detroit and Chicago and areas like this. The church, as a matter of fact, in Chicago and in Detroit, in both places, have set up committees for working with those people who have come from the Kentucky area who have migrated there to try and get them jobs and things to do.
What kinds of jobs do they get? The high school graduates, what kinds of jobs in the whole do you find that they've got when they have left this community?
there wouldn't be much there, the clerk in Sears and Roebuck's or the clerk in the stores and places like this.
Do you have any young people at all who stay here?
Yes, we have young people who stay here, and you can see them today, many of them, walking around this community or sitting in front of the courthouse, a good portion of them with nothing to do. Those who have had the opportunity to get a job, take it. They're not prone to sitting back and waiting for a handout. They'd like to work. And those who can find a job are working. Most of them can't. The young people have two things they can do. One is they can go to a drive-in movie or a regular movie theater. And the other is they can go to a drive-in restaurant. And up until December, this was the only thing they could do. There was nothing else for them in Hazard except to go to school. In December, we opened a bowling alley, and this has helped tremendously as far as just giving them a play type of recreation. But anything constructive, there still is nothing constructive as far as recreation for the teenager is concerned. We have a bowling alley, and that's the limit. The coal industry is not going to re-employ the tremendous number of people that it once employed. And this is what we need. We need industry here to employ the people.
Yes, I think that when our highways are finished and we have better transportation, get some of the dams built that has been proposed where we'll have industrial water, I think that we will naturally find ourselves getting new industry.
We have several research programs in effect at this particular time.
Chemical or byproduct companies could come in because you have all the ingredients or components that you need. Gasoline can be made out of coal that would compete with any of the gasolines on the market today.
This is one of the areas that the coal industry has sadly neglected, and now of course we're trying to overcome that neglect and do quite a bit of research. It's such a involved and detailed and very costly venture that one local community or even one state would have quite a bit of a problem in raising the money. The federal government set up the Office of Coal Research and appropriated $5 million, I think, this year to run that office, which is a very small token amount for that type of program. They have not developed any type of effort that would include the whole industry or the whole community, in fact.
Well, community development seems to be a great cry all over the country. Everybody's in on the act of dipping into ARA funds and state resource development funds and the competition for that type of activity throughout the country is about as great as business competition is. And of course, Hazard is no different. Sure, we're looking forward to long-range planning in cooperation with the state government.
We have a development group, area development group. Mayor Willie Dahlhauser is the head of it, and we have quite a few of the Chamber of Commerce and Junior Chamber of Commerce. They're all working to do everything they can do. We have a program now of a Magic Mountain project, which would be a tourist attraction and would be a model coal mine, which would employ about 300 people. So I think that if they would get a few to, if they start building better roads and tourist facilities, I think that the area would be a great tourist center because we have wonderful mountains. We have all kinds of land that's untenable. It's just mountainous, and it's beautiful trails, and there's no wild animals or not many snakes or anything here to bother people. It's a great and a fabulous place for a resort area. And the mountains are not too high. They're not like the Smokies or they're not like the Big Black. They're really accessible. I think that's our answer. And small crafts, home crafts, crafts that each family individually could make certain things to sell, like we have some of it already started. The reason I say that, baskets and chairs and weaving and handmade things, you know, that the tourists would buy. Would help the tourists and help our area, too.
It seems to me like that they talk of a lot of things in the way of recreation and one thing or another, which any of it is good so far as it lasts. But actually, the needs of the people who are here, their homes are here, it's the only place they can go. There has to be something that will sustain life for those people. I don't see how that tourists are going to... The man that lives over here on a little farm half a mile or quarter of a mile from here, and he has no job, I actually don't see where that...
Well, this mining town I live in is a dead and lonely place, where pity and starvation are pictured on every face.
You have been listening to 40 Cents a Ton, a documentary about the unofficial strike of Kentucky miners. In the program were strike leaders Berman Gibson, Preacher Smith, Grand Noble, a retired miner, Harley Caldwell, and Mrs. Smith and Mrs. Noble, Mrs. Nolan and Louise Hatmaker of the Hazard Herald, C.E. Bean, President, District 30 of the United Mine Workers of America, Reverend Nagley and Reverend Carroll of St. Mark's Episcopal Church and Hazard Christian Church, respectively, Drs. Creeley and Potter of the Harlan Miners Memorial Hospital, Ed Johnson, a non-union mine owner, Brian Whitfield III, a union mine owner, and Floyd McDowell, president of Harlan County Coal Operators Association, and Lee Crutchfield, president of Hazard Chamber of Commerce. Singing were Pete Seeger and Phil Ox, who wrote Mining is a Hazard. The program was engineered by Sam Sanders and produced for Pacifica Radio with the assistance of Stanley Aronowitz and Bob Heifetz by Hamish Sinclair of the WBAI Public Affairs Department.
The Depression was ended with the war, but nobody told Kentucky that is sure. Some are living in a sewer while the jobs are getting fewer, but more coal is mined than never was before. Cause mining is a hazard in Hazard, Kentucky, and if you aren't mining there, friends are mighty lucky, cause if you don't get silicosis or pay that's just atrocious, you'll be screaming for a union that will care.
You've been listening to 40 Cents a Ton, a 1963 documentary recorded in Hazard County, Kentucky, from Pacifica Radio. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project that is supported by listeners like you. This program was preserved thanks to a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts in 2011. This year, we are preserving more tapes thanks to the California Audiovisual Preservation Project and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. And of course, we thank listeners like you. Please visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org or call us at 1-800-735-0230. I've been your host, Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.